محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Another misunderstanding between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, reportedly has been resolved. This, as it appears, a technical issue related to one of the Iranian sites has been taken care of. Iran continues its cooperation with the IAEA, but has cut back on some of its volunteer cooperation due to the United States totally leaving the JCPOA nuclear deal in 2018. However, despite Tehran's cooperation, there always seems to be some accusation by the IAEA of the Islamic Republic not abiding by its responsibilities. What is the reality? Stay with us as we take a look at this and more on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Daniel Kovalek, Professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh, School of Law, out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Shabir Rezvi, Political Analyst, out of London. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Dan, I'd like to start off with you. I mean, there are reports that two of the most recent concerns by the IAEA have been resolved or clarified. Do you think that Tehran tries to cooperate with the IAEA, or do you see Iran lacking in trying to cooperate with the organization?
I think they do try to cooperate with the organization. And honestly, I don't really know why, given that it never satisfies anyone. It never, you know, leads to reduced sanctions. But yeah, I do think Iran, you know, acts in a very honorable way regarding the nuclear issue. Again, even though it has no obligation to do so, even though the U.S. unilaterally backed out of the nuclear deal, as was mentioned 5 years ago, and yet Iran continues to cooperate.
Well, Shabir, what about there? There seems to be continuous concern for the agency, by the agency, when it comes to Iran. When one issue is resolved, there seems to be another which appears. Do you think this is the case or not? And if so, why is this the case?
Hello, good evening.
Good evening.
Look, at the end of the day, I have many times been speaking on this matter and commented that the reality is that, as our colleague from Pittsburgh said, that it's really quite surprising that Iran continues to cooperate when they really don't get any mileage. One after another, issues are raised. And really, the whole nuclear issue, in my view, has been really a red herring because Iran has continuously, over the last 20-odd years, said that they are not interested in having nuclear weapons. They do not believe nuclear weapons provide any security to any nation. And they are emphatically of the view that nuclear weapons should be disbanded. So it's not really on the agenda of the Islamic Republic to have nuclear weapons. But what is important is that the IAEA and the Western powers use their leverage really for Iran not to have any defensive armament industry developed, because recently, in the last few days, Iran tested the 2,000-kilometer ballistic missile. That, I think, is what is on the agenda, is really to disarm Iran in one way or another leaving aside the nuclear issue, because Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has quite clearly stated that nuclear weapons are against Islam. When it comes to other issues, they sort of take the speeches or the rulings of the religious scholars as sort of dangerous and extremist. But on this particular issue, when it has been continuously reiterated and explained to the Western powers that Iran is just not interested in nuclear weapons, they want to use it for civilian purposes, and which they have a right under all kinds of international rules and regulations that they can continue to do so. So whether it's for medical or other areas of civilian use, which are allowed within the current rules.
Well, Dan, how is it that Tehran is constantly being pressured and even threatened, but when the U.S. left the JCPOA, nothing was really done, nor did Washington have to pay any compensations for not sticking with its obligations? Your take on that and possible double standards in the IAEA?
Well, there's a lot of double standards here. Of course, we have also Israel, that is a non-declared nuclear power with anywhere between 100 to 200, nuclear warheads. We don't know how many, because, again, they haven't declared it, but it's the worst-kept secret in the world that they have them, and they're not sanctioned at all. But, you know, again, we don't have a rule of law in the world. We have a rule of the mighty against, you know, the weaker countries, and the U.S. has all the military power, and, of course, it's backing Israel, and so that's why they are not sanctioned. It comes down to that, really.
Hmm. Well, Shabir, do you think the agency is acting like an independent entity? Because Iran continues to tell the IAEA to not let themselves be politically manipulated. Your thoughts?
Well, this is the whole problem, that whether it's IAEA or other United Nations agencies, they really are instruments of Washington and reality. All the sort of Western powers coalesce together with Washington on matters of this nature. So whether you take the Human Rights Body, you take the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank or whatever, any entity, as I said, which runs under the auspices or otherwise, really carries the line of the Washington consensus, which is really to sort of control and manipulate poorer nations, nations that are unable to stand up to the might of the United States. But I think what's also interesting is that, Mr. Pompeo famously said that we lie, we cheat, and we steal. And not only that, we have a manual at the CIS to teach the cadets, and people were clapping and laughing. So that, I think, clearly shows that America and her allies lie continuously, they cheat continuously, and they steal from the poorer nations. So at the end of the day, the policy that Iran has adopted is to engage, at the same time also having the integrity to stand by its own dignity and try to manage the difficult situations that have been created due to sanctions and the manipulation of the international agencies.
Well, Dan, Shabir brought up an interesting point about basically all of the organizations under the guise of the United Nations. It was created to prop up American hegemony. With that being the case, when you have certain situations, let's take the nuclear situation, we're dealing with that. I mean, what should independent countries do? Because, of course, they're going to try to use their leverage, and they will sanction, or they will, so many things that they will try to implement, if not abiding. So your thoughts on the option, the alternative of what should be done?
There's not a lot of options. That's the problem. You know, for countries that aren't as strong as the United States, and that's most countries of the world, if they act afoul of, you know, U.S. desires, whatever those may be in any given instance, they risk having economic sanctions leveled against them, maybe even military action against them. And again, when you have a power like the U.S. that has the power of the sword, as we say, the power to punish other countries, many times have to, essentially bend to the will of the United States. And it's irrelevant what the law is. It's irrelevant what the United Nations says or any U.N. body. They just have to capitulate, whether they think that's correct or not. You know, you had this case, it should be mentioned, I think it was a couple of years ago, Iran won a case at the International Court of Justice, at least won it in part, saying some of the sanctions the U.S. has against Iran are illegal. And so the U.S. simply said, okay, we're not going to honor that decision. And by the way, we're going to just pull out generally of the ICJ, and, we're going to use it when we want to and not be subject to it when we don't. You know, so again, there's no rule of law, and countries basically have to endure what they have to endure, sadly.
Well, Shabir, at the end of the day, do you think the real goal of the West is to try to prevent Iran from advancing technologically?
But that's very clear that that has been the intention for the last 43 years. And if you look at the history of the last 43 years, that it has had continuous sanctions that have been applied so that it cannot progress economically, cannot progress militarily, is unable to sort of create intellectual capital. But the remarkable thing is Iran has continued to progress with all the sanctions that have been applied in the last 43 years. And, it's quite incredible that it continues to progress in this manner, no matter what Washington and Washington's vassal states, want to do. But what one has to really evaluate is that, yes, USA does have a sword, and it does wield that sword continuously, either through economic sanctions, diplomatic sanctions, perhaps even military sanctions, regime change. These are the tools that are available within the arsenal that USA has. But, what's happening globally, geopolitically, and geoeconomically in the last year, 2 years, shows very clearly that what I call the vulnerable nations of the world, and that includes Russia, China, India, big nations, powerful nations in their own right, are really Brazil, South Africa. They're all saying that in reality, what we have to do is to get together so that we can really stand up to the USA, because otherwise what USA does is sort of eliminate one particular nation and then move on to the other one. Mm-hmm. However, when the Southern Hemisphere countries decide to work together, that I think would be a real challenge, and it is proving to be a challenge to the U.S. might.
Well, Dan, about trying to prevent Iran from advancing technologically, according to Shabir, and the reality is that they have not been able to do that. So after more than 40 years of trying to pressure Iran, and they see that Iran continues advancing, one would think that perhaps they would try another method, because obviously that one hasn't worked. But we continue to see the same old, same old. I mean, why is that the case in your perspective?
Well, wasn't it Albert Einstein that said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and hoping for different results?
Right.
I think our leaders are insane. I mean, I'm sorry, they're not acting in any rational capacity. You know, Iran is willing to deal with the United States. It helped in the war on terror. And after some time after the war on terror, Iran sent a proposal to the White House proposing a grand bargain with the United States to try to deal with all the issues of mutual concern, and the U.S. never even responded to it. The fact is the U.S. could work with Iran if it wanted to, and that would be the rational decision here. Instead, they continue to try to punish Iran, frankly, for having overthrown the U.S.-backed dictator in 1979, but this is not a rational policy. It's a policy of spite, a policy motivated by the desire for control. And given that, the U.S. just keeps moving forward with the same failed policies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Shabir, how much of the U.S. policies do you think, when we're looking at, whether we're talking about the relationship with Iran or specifically in dealing with the IAEA nuclear talks, how much do you think that the Zionist regime plays in all of this? That Washington is not particularly looking at what's perhaps best even for the American people or the United States, but more importantly, the interests of the regime in Tel Aviv.
Well, indeed, that is the reality of the situation, is that the Zionist entity's colonial sort of project, which was implanted by my government, by the British government, way back, nearly 100 years ago, when the Balfour Declaration was proposed, and under that auspices, the Zionist entity came into creation in 1948. And of course, American presidents continuously since that time have sort of put all the support that is required to sort of take away any blame from the rulers in Tel Aviv, whether it's the killing of Palestinians. I mean, you know, since the beginning of this year, virtually every day an individual Palestinian has been killed and assassinated in the occupied territories. Recently, we had bombing taking place in Gaza, and this seems to be a sort of a regular feature every year. It continues. And I think the most telling comment really is from Netanyahu himself. Only recently, he said 95% of the threat to Israel comes from Iran. So, you know, when the leader of a nation says that the main threat is from Israel, from Iran, then that shows clearly that the U.S. wants to protect Israel. And if tomorrow, let's say, when the Reza Shah Pahlavi was in power, Iran had very good relationship with Israel, and oil was being supplied at a discounted rate. But as soon as Imam Khomeini came into power, that relationship was completely cut off. And that in itself has created huge problems for Iran. If tomorrow Iran decides to, have a diplomatic relationship with Israel, then nuclear weapons, human rights issues, all kinds of things will be put on the back burner, and Iran would become part of the so-called, group of civilized nations.
Dan, how much of this is related to the hegemonic media there? We talked about, Shabir talked about the Israeli regime, and we talked about as far as the interests of Tel Aviv perhaps being more important sometimes to Washington than the United States itself. But isn't the reality is that the people of the United States have no idea of the reality, whether we're talking about Israel and Israeli crimes, whether we're talking about Iran and actually abiding by their commitments, or whether we're talking about the United States itself and not really abiding by its commitments. It is the reality is that the populace in the United States is extremely ignorant of the reality thus no pressure actually is exerted against the government.
Well, of course, that's true. Americans are, I would say, uniquely ignorant in the world about many things, about history, about their own history, certainly world history, geography. Many Americans couldn't even find Iran on the map or even Israel on the map. You know, after 9/11, there was a popular country song where the singer says he doesn't know the difference between Iran and Iraq, and he said it proudly, you know. When you have that situation, you in uninformed populace, of course, they won't push back on any of this because they have no idea about the long history, again, of the U.S. supporting the murderous Shah in Iran. They don't know why there was a revolution in 1979. They don't know that Iran has helped in the war on terror. They have no, they just know nothing. And given that, yeah, it's very hard for change to come to the United States.
You know, Dan, you just said something. I remember once I was in the States and actually at university and showing some slides on Iran, and this was on a university setting, and someone was surprised to know that people actually live in houses, in buildings. They were thinking that they lived in, like, deserts. Like, it was quite unbelievable to that level of a lack of knowledge of the reality of what happens in other countries. Well, Shabir, you've pointed to this, alluded to this earlier, about the rise of this multilateral world. There's the unilateral world is ending, and we're entering a new phase. Your perspective on how much this will change the reality on the ground, whether we're talking about IAEA or other organizations under the United Nations, because there is going to be a different dynamic, and it's already in the making. Your take.
Well, indeed, new dynamics is in the making. Obviously, because the whole sort of web that USA has created after the Second World War of United Nations, other organizations, as I've said, and, you know, money sort of transferring through SWIFT, the banking system, and all sort of instruments that have been created, it's not easy technically to come out of that. But I think a great effort is being made by whether it's the BRIC countries or SCO or the Eurasian nations together to really challenge this hegemonic madness, if you like, whereby a particular nation feels that they have special rights and no one else has any other rights at all. And I think people have been really trying to create the situation for many years, but it was becoming difficult. However, we can see that lots of things have happened since the Ukraine war and sanctions on Russia, and then, of course, the whole issue of Taiwan and China, and continuously it carries on to sort of create this sort of war situation, a continuous sort of war footing that Washington wants to sort of have, because obviously it benefits the armaments trade and the military industrial complex. But I think people of the world have really awakened that what is happening is not in their interest. And really, the situation is that only 15% of the global population lives in countries like the European Union, United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. 85% of the world population does not live in that particular region. And they have been deprived, manipulated, and the governments have been changed through color revolutions and all kinds of other manipulations. So I think we are living through extraordinary times, not just interesting times, but extraordinary times where things are moving so rapidly that even analysts and commentators can't really keep pace with it. But I think it's a good omen for the world
global population.
Okay. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Daniel Kovalek, professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law, out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. By the way, Dan, nice picture behind your head, like the painting. Xavier Rezvi, political analyst out of London. And as always, I appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
Imam Reza lively debates. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest felicitations to you on a very auspicious day. Today, the 11th of the sacred month of Dhul-Qa'dah, is the birth anniversary of a very blessed person whose shrine in the northeastern city of Mashhad makes it the holiest spot in Iran. Mashhad, the capital of Khorasan province, has for the past few days become the cynosure of the eyes of the faithful, whether in Iran or anywhere around the world. Pilgrims are pouring in from various places, and according to estimates, those assembled this city at the sprawling golden domed mausoleum number around 2 million. There are some who have traveled on foot from different provinces of Iran. The city wears a festive look. It has been bedecked with flowers and colorful fluorescent lights in honor of the person who reposes in eternal peace. He is none other than Imam Reza, peace upon him, the 8th infallible heir of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. For your information, his birth anniversary marks the culmination of Dahiye Keramat, or the 10 days of munificence, which the Islamic Republic of Iran celebrates every year from the 1st of Dhul-Qa'dah, the day the 8th Imam's virtuous sister, Hazrat Fatima Masume, whose shrine is in Qom, was born several years after the birthday of her brother. Before we present you a special feature on this blessed occasion, here are some words of wisdom from Imam Reza, peace upon him, to ponder upon in order to enlighten our hearts and minds. Hypocrites are characterized by three features: telling lies, reneging on promises, and breaching of trust. This apt description of many of the supposedly prominent people of our own times are not the words of any starry-eyed philosopher, nor sure of what he says, nor of a scholar who does not practice what he preaches, and neither of any political
thinker, constantly changing his views as per the direction in which the wind blows. These are the words of a person whom God Almighty granted eternity to such an extent that till this day, even after the passing of over a millennium and 2.5 centuries since his physical departure from the world, he continues to rule the hearts and minds of the believers. Imam Reza, peace upon him, needs no introduction to anyone familiar with Islam, the school of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt, and Iran's history, culture, and contemporary events. Born in Holy Medina in 148 AH, corresponding to 766 AD, 2 weeks after the martyrdom of his grandfather, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, to Imam Musa Kazim and his pious wife, Hazrat Najme, peace upon them, he was destined to find his final resting place at the age of 55 in distant Khorasan, northeastern Iran, where he was forced to come from Hejaz by the self-styled caliph Ma'mun of the usurper Abbasid regime. Afraid of the popularity of the imam among the Muslim ummah, and in order to deceive the people, the crafty Ma'mun deceitfully declared the prophet's venerable descendant as his heir apparent, although Imam Reza, peace upon him, was some 20 years older than him in age. He showed outward respect to the imam, and when his plots to mislead the people failed, he had the guest secretly poisoned to death and then joined the funeral in black clothes, pretending that he was innocent of murder. Ma'mun was thus a hypocrite who used to lie glibly, renege on his own promises, and breach the trust. Let us focus on one of the debates of Imam Reza, peace upon him, who, as repository of divine knowledge, spared no efforts during his 20-year imamat to enlighten Muslims and all those who came into contact with him, including Jews, Christians, Sabians, Zoroastrians, Hindus, and atheists. Following the martyrdom of his father, Imam Kazim, peace upon him, in 183 AH in Baghdad, in the prison of the Abbasid tyrant Harun, he traveled to the port city of Basra in Iraq in order to disprove the claims of those who deviated from the truth. Imam Reza, peace upon him, stayed in the house of a Hashemite kinsman named Hassan ibn Muhammad al-Alawi and held a session for a group of Muslims, amongst whom was Amr ibn Haddab, who had deviated from the path of the Ahlul Bayt. In this session of a lively debate, a Jewish rabbi and a Christian priest were also present. The imam told them that they have been invited so that they can ask him about Islam, the Prophet's Sunnah, and the legacy of the God-given authority of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Amr ibn Haddab said to him, "I am told that you know all that which God has sent down, including the various languages the people speak." Imam Reza, peace upon him, replied in the affirmative, which made Amr say, "First of all, I want to test you through languages. This is a Roman, this is an Indian, this is an Iranian, and this is a Turk. We have brought them before you." The imam said that, by the will of God, he would answer them in their own languages if they raise any question. To the utter astonishment of Amr, the Jewish rabbi, the Christian priest, and the people of other ethnicities who were present, Imam Reza, peace upon him, fluently spoke with each of them in their native languages, that is, Latin, Sanskrit, Persian, and Turkish. After answering the questions of the non-Arabs, Imam Reza, peace upon him, turned to Amr ibn Khattab and said in flawless Arabic that he will be tried in these days on charges of murdering one of his blood relations. At this, Amr expressed doubt, saying that none except God has knowledge of the unseen. The Imam drew his attention to what God has said in the Noble Quran, that He, the Almighty, who is the knower of the unseen, does not reveal His secrets to any except to Him whom He chooses as the Prophet. The Imam added, "We are the inheritors of God's last and greatest messenger, who informed us of what was and what will be till the day of resurrection." It is said that as per the prediction of Imam Reza, peace upon him, 5 days later, Amr ibn Khattab suffered the fate of which he was foretold, and confessed that he had been concealing his crime of murder of which no one else was informed. Imam Reza, peace upon him, then held lively discussions with the Christian priest and the Jewish rabbi, quoting from the various Gospels of the Bible, the Torah, and other sacred texts of Judaism, including the Psalms of David. To the amazement of the Christian and the Jew, the Imam proved to them the real meaning of so many passages in the Old and New Testaments, pointing out that these pertain to the mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The two argued with the Imam for some days, but couldn't prove that Jesus or Ezra had ever claimed to be sons of God, as alleged by the Christians and Jews, respectively. On the contrary, Imam Reza, peace upon him, proved to them that Moses, Jesus, and other prophets had given the Israelites the tidings of the advent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. To their utter surprise, by quoting passages from their religious scriptures, Imam Reza, peace upon him, pointed out that these are direct references to not just the Prophet of Islam, but to his divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, and to the latter sons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, as well as to Prophet's immaculate daughter, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon them all. During the Imam's stay in Basra, the Christian priest embraced the truth of Islam and decided to travel to Medina to become more familiar with Islamic teachings, especially the classes that the eighth Imam used to hold in the holy city. The Jewish rabbi, after debating with Imam Reza, peace upon him, was full of admiration for his deep knowledge, eloquence, and rational interpretation of what was mentioned about the last prophet and his blessed household, the Ahlul Bayt, in the scriptures revealed by God to Moses and other prophets. Several years later, when Imam Reza, peace upon him, came to Khorasan, Ma'mun also tried to test the knowledge of the Prophet's righteous successor by assembling in the city of Marv scholars of the Jews, Christians, Zoroastrians, Sabians, Hindus, and atheists. Needless to say, the Imam not only triumphed in these debates, but convinced most of them to become Muslim. These and other developments unnerved Ma'mun, and he decided to return to Baghdad by taking the Imam with him. But while halting at Tus, He deceitfully made the imam eat poisoned grapes. The result was the martyrdom of Imam Reza, peace upon him, and his being laid to rest in Khorasan. Here we present you an excellent description of the human heart and its functions by the 8th Imam, peace upon him. As for the heart, it is one of Allah's marvelous signs in the human body, since it pumps the blood to all parts of the body, and the blood conveys food and oxygen in order to distribute them throughout the body, and then it arranges for the discharge of waste products from the body of them. The heart pumps the blood to the lungs so that they may take adequate supply of oxygen from the air which a person breathes. In the lungs, the blood gets rid of some waste products which it gathers from the parts of the blood and which take form of a gas called carbon dioxide. The heart also pumps the blood to the kidneys. As for the regulation of the beats of the heart, it is one of the secrets of creation. The average of the beats of the heart is 70 times per minute, which amounts to 100,000 times a day, 40 million times a year, and over 2,000 millions in middle age. Therefore, we must think of this great glorification which never ceases nor flags by night and day. Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
With reporters.
The Resistance Festival in Brussels has gathered Palestinian rights campaigners from across Belgium and beyond. Israel's murder of innocent civilians and the regime's ongoing illegal activities in the occupied territories has been highlighted.
The Nakba has been going for three quarters of a century now, and we're talking about brutal colonialism and occupation in its most ugly form imaginable. Yeah, people are angry.
Apartheid, ethnic cleansing, segregation, siege, all forms of ethnic cleansing and colonialism. The Palestinian political prisoners also.
Tel Aviv authorities continue to destroy Palestinian homes and develop stolen land for settlers. Activists are calling on everyone living in the EU to stop buying Israeli products.
Yes, I think there should be boycotts, I think there should be sanctions, I think there should be punishment.
I think it's absolutely vital that we continue to support them in their struggle against fascism and imperialism.
We are here, helpless and hopeless sometimes. We feel
and we cannot protect our people in Gaza. This is painful, very painful.
Even though the United Nations classifies Israel's activities as illegal under international law, the EU seems to suggest that both sides are to blame for the occupation.
We are consistently urging all parties to exercise maximum restraint and not to contribute to escalation, but to the contrary.
When it comes to the war in Ukraine, there is no such mixed messaging from the EU. Russia has always been the only aggressor, end of story. Rights campaigners say Palestinians will be free eventually, insisting it's simply a matter of time. Given that the European Union is so willing to impose sanctions when it falls in line with the wishes of the United States, those gathered here are calling on EU leaders to finally muster some courage and put Israel under real pressure. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has won another term, garnering 52.16% of the vote. Right after the announcement of the runoff results Sunday night, opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu thanked the 25 million Turkish citizens who voted for him, especially youth and women, and promised to continue the struggle for democracy with his alliance.
The means of the state has been entirely pledged to one person. I could never stay silent when your rights were violated. I could never tolerate you becoming second-class citizens after millions of refugees came here. I fought for all this and I will continue to fight.
For her part, Good Party leader Meral Akşener congratulated President Erdogan on winning a new term and called her supporters and those who cast their vote in favor of the opposition candidate not to feel pessimism or loss, assuring that election is the most fundamental display of democracy.
Don't forget that we are still here at the parliament. We will continue to fulfill our responsibility. I want to congratulate Mr. Erdogan for being elected, but he should not forget that the polls conveyed messages to him as well.
Akşener delivered her speech from the Good Party headquarters in Ankara, rather than the area opposition alliance designated to celebrate their victory in the case of winning. Analysts believe the only reason those six political parties agreed to nominate one candidate despite their ideological differences is to gather their efforts and oust Erdogan. And with that not achieved, the nation alliance is likely to be divided.
I think in the coming few days, we may see divisions and resignations in the Turkish opposition, especially that the table of six gathered unseat President Erdogan. On the other hand, I think the People Alliance and ruling AK Party will be facing a lot of challenges because Turkey is already struggling with economic crisis, the refugee crisis, and some problems with the neighboring countries. The People Alliance must work harder now that they will govern the country.
More than 25 million Turkish citizens voted for opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. This election had been seen as Erdogan's biggest challenge, for the Nation Alliance was very close to unseating him. Now that the presidential run is over, political parties have already started preparing for the upcoming local election in 2024, with Erdogan promising his supporters a win in both opposition strongholds, the capital Ankara and the economic hub, Istanbul. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards nonviolent protesters. Many of France's yellow vests were glad the subject was reported upon. But the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the Yellow Vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 Yellow Vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries.
The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely and will likely scare many away from even observing a yellow vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy, why the yellow vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a two-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the Yellow Vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France, and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Al-Quds International Institution has held its annual meeting of the Board of Trustees in Damascus. The meeting was attended by Palestine's ambassador to Syria, Syria-based Palestinian factions, and Syrian President Assad's political and media advisor, Buthayna Sha'ban, who is also board secretary in the institution. She called for the unity of the Arab and Islamic world in order to liberate Palestine. She set the case of Syria as an example for Palestinians that victory is undoubtedly the result of steadfastness.
Arabs have returned back to Syria. The difficult experience Syria went through for over a decade is a beautiful lesson for Palestinians that those who believe in their cause the most will triumph. President Assad's presence in the Arab League summit is not just a victory announcement for Syria, but also signals the failure of huge plots made by strongest world powers.
Speakers highlighted the heroic resistance of Palestinians in the battle codenamed Revenge of the Free in the Gaza Strip. They called for confronting Israeli attempts to Judaize Al-Aqsa Mosque, reiterating that Quds will remain the eternal capital of Palestine. The meeting comes following an Arab League summit and reconciliations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as well as Syria and the Arab world. Such developments, according to speeches delivered, indicate that the world is heading towards a multipolar system where the West's hegemony is demolished. Speakers underlined the importance of reminding the world of the Palestinian cause and the suffering of the people of Palestine caused by the Israeli occupation. Despite the decades-long Western double standards, institutions like this believe that Palestinians' steadfastness will eventually lead them to restoring their rights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
UN bodies issue fresh warnings about the impacts of huge fan gaps in Afghanistan. The latest such warning comes from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Afghanistan, which says urgent funding is needed to avert an imminent large-scale humanitarian catastrophe. Afghan experts are also worried about funds drying up and the international community turning its eyes from the war-torn nation.
Definitely, the only way out of the Afghanistan crisis is constructive engagement between the ruling Taliban and the global community. This year, hopes of heeding Afghanistan's appeal for financial aid are fading and it is very threatening. Shortfalls in funding absolutely deal another devastating blow to the Afghan nation, especially the most vulnerable citizens. We will witness more poverty, unemployment, and devastation in Afghanistan if funds continue to dry up.
The United Nations has launched a humanitarian appeal for $4.62 billion to assist nearly 24 million Afghans in 2023. However, the appeal has received very little support so far, with only 6.4% of the required funding secured. This has forced many aid organizations to scale back their activities, leaving many without help.
Aid cuts are a disaster. People like us are eyeing international assistance. We have no job and income, so relief aid can be a lifeline for us. Some are sick, they need free treatment. Some are in dire need of food and cash aid. People will die in their houses and on the streets in the absence of global aid. They have no money for themselves. First, they are relying on God's mercy, and second, on the relief aid.
Major aid cuts, Western sanctions, and the freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. are exacerbating Afghanistan crisis. Afghans have been calling on the U.S. to release the funds and to lift the sanctions, saying they are hurting and punishing innocent people who are already suffering from poverty, famine, and hunger. Afghanistan is facing a severe funding shortfall that threatens the lives of millions of Afghan people. Aid agencies warn that the global community must act urgently to prevent a humanitarian disaster. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
South Korea and the U.S. Thursday began large-scale joint military exercises just 25 kilometers south of the fortified border with North Korea. The drills utilize some 600 weapons, including stealth fighter jets, attack helicopters, and South Korea's homegrown K2 tanks. Participants suggest the drills are meant to be a warning.
I think it sends a message generally to the whole world about how strong the alliance is, and that conducting these readiness exercises builds our credibility as an alliance.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to respond assertively to North Korea's missile and nuclear development, in lockstep with American forces, which have 28,500 troops in South Korea. For South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, these drills demonstrate peace through strength, the policy of promoting a strong alliance with the United States. Detractors argue that these drills will upset China, provoke North Korea, and generate a regional arms race. North Korea views such drills as a rehearsal for invasion and has previously vowed to respond militarily. And some South Koreans suggest the drills damage the prospects for peace.
When dialogue between the two Koreas progressed, dialogue between the U.S. and North Korea progressed, and large-scale military exercises were suspended, easing tensions and bringing peace. Large-scale military exercises don't enhance the security of South Korea. Rather, they undermine South Korea's security.
Four more rounds of similar large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea live-fire drills are scheduled through mid-June. Frank Smith, Pochon, South Korea.
During the Tel Aviv regime's 11-day offensive in 2021, Israeli warplanes carried out one of the most horrendous massacres in one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. The attacks destroyed three residential buildings, killing 44 civilians, including 18 children. Rescue teams took days to pull the bodies from under the rubble. Riyad Shkuntana and his six-year-old daughter were among the survivors.
When the Israeli warplanes hit the building where we used to live in 2021, we were buried under the destroyed building. I spent 12 hours under the rubble before the rescue team could save me. I could hear the screams of my children calling me from under the debris. But my daughter Susie and I were the only survivors of my family. They told me that my wife and four of my children hadn't been able to make it when they found their bodies.
During the latest Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, the family suffered again. Israeli jet fighters targeted the apartment adjacent to theirs.
I was playing with my cousins in the other room. Suddenly we heard a massive explosion. I directly rushed to my grandma. I was screaming and crying. The house was filled with smoke. I was frightened that the building might fall on us. We realized that the building next to ours was targeted. We escaped from our apartment, and so did all the other residents.
Susie hasn't been able to speak about the 2021 incident ever since it happened. She becomes speechless anytime she remembers what happened to her and her family back then. Talking to Press TV, Her father asserted that there is no safe place in Gaza for his daughter, even though they demanded international protection after the 2021 incident.
It's all lies. Palestinian civilians are never protected from Israeli attacks. We don't trust international protection regulations. She had therapeutic sessions for 2 years, but my daughter is still suffering, and that memory haunts her anytime she hears a loud sound. She deserves to live in peace and security.
Susie Shkuntana is an example of thousands of Palestinian children